Amateur Radio Newsline report number 1859, with the release date of March 29th, 2013, to follow in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. The Wireless Institute of Australia takes a bold stand to try and keep part of the 2300 megahertz band. The FCC grants hams special temporary authority to use TDMA technology, and a special April 1st report on the emerging science of flavored mini computers. All this and more on Amateur Radio Newsline report number 1859, coming your way right now.
From around the world, this is Newsline, Amateur Radio's independent on-the-air news and bulletin service. Now, here is Jim Davis, W2JKD.
Australia's National Ham Radio Society says that it's not going to give up the 13-centimeter amateur band without a fight. This after the Australian Communications and Media Authority, the ACMA, proposes to withdraw the 2300 to 2302 megahertz segment of the band as of July 2015 so it can be reallocated for other uses. Roger Harrison, VK2ZRH of the WIA News, has the details.
The driver behind the ACMA's proposed move is to create a tidy 100 megahertz wide band from 2300 to 2400 megahertz for the purpose of spectrum licensing by auction. The 13-centimeter amateur band has only a secondary service status at 2300 to 2450 megahertz. Primary user status goes to the fixed, mobile, and radio location services. The 2300 to 2302 meg segment has been used for narrowband weak signal working, and this is reflected in the WIA band plan for 13 centimetres. In the face of the ACMA's proposal, the WIA intends to fight back. The WIA is preparing a submission that strongly argues for the retention of a 150 kHz wide allocation at 2300 megs on at least a co-primary basis. A 150 kHz wide line in the sand, you might say. Some have suggested that the Institute should bargain the loss of 2 megs in the 13-centimetre band for more spectrum elsewhere, like the 80-metre DX window or securing exclusive access to 50 to 52 megs, for example. However, the WIA board has adopted the stance that this is no time to roll over and die on the 13-centimetre issue, to use the loss of 2 megs as a bargaining chip when it comes to issues affecting other bands, or, for that matter, bargaining for a new band elsewhere in the radio frequency spectrum. Each issue really has to be addressed on its own merits. This is Roger Harrison, VK2ZRH.
The decision of the Wireless Institute of Australia to stand its ground to keep at least a small part of the 13-centimeter band is not as unusual as it first may seem. As broadband expands and other services are displaced from their spectrum, many are looking for band space to relocate. And as such, the ham radio bands at 420 and above are quickly becoming a prime target of these outsiders. Because of this, more and more national ham radio societies are finding that there are only two ways to fight back. The first is to become politically active in their nation. The other is to do what the Wireless Institute of Australia is doing by literally drawing a proverbial do-not-cross line in the sand. Some good news for a ham radio operator in Nelson, New Zealand, who was being hounded by a neighbor to take down his antenna. This because, she said, it interfered with her view of the surrounding landscape. The town council says that the antenna can stay. Amateur Radio Newsline's Jim Meachin, ZL2BHF, has this follow-up report.
According to information supplied by Andrew Mackey, ZL2HZ, the Nelson City Council has no intention to proceed with the complaint filed against a ham radio antenna installation owned by Rick Kiesig, ZL2HAM. As reported last week, the complainant, Dallas Woods, had appeared before the City Council alleging that Kiesig's tower and antenna interfered with her landscape overlay view. Among other things, she asked council members to change the rules so that amateur radio antennas are no longer a permitted activity in residential zones. But in a phone call from Rachel Reese on behalf of the entire Nelson City Council, Mackey was told that the council does not intend to proceed with the complaint from Woods at this time, nor is it proposing to make any intermediate changes to the district land use regulations that permit antenna systems such as that of ZL2HAM. rather at some time in the future, and only if land use regulations come up for review, it might possibly take another look at amateur antennas, but limited to geographic areas where the view is perceived to be important. According to Mackey, this is a major step towards maintaining the good relations between the Nelson City Council and the area's amateur radio community. It also ensures that continued cooperation in areas of civil defence and other activities will not be adversely affected. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Jim Meachins at L2BHF in Nelson, New Zealand.
The bottom line is that the Nelson City Council agrees that Kiesig's tower and antenna installation complies with all relevant regulations, and as such, he's free to enjoy his hobby without further outside interference. On the other side of the globe, broadcast AM radio for emergency alerts appears to be on its way out in the United Kingdom. Now, even though at the present time it remains the quickest and easiest way to reach the masses in time of national crisis, Jason Law, VK2LAW, has those details.
A government report indicates an intention to abandon AM broadcast radio for emergency communications and to phase out AM broadcasting from 2016. The report impact of a radio switchover on the government's emergency communications policy says the coverage of AM services are near universal across the UK, delivered by a small number of transmitters which could more easily be restored in the event of a national disaster. However, while AM services are universally available, the number of households which both have access to and choose to access such services is on the decline. The declining value of the AM platform is best displayed in the case of the National Attack Warning System, NAWS. The use of the BBC Radio 4 long-wave frequency to broadcast emergency information nationally in the case of a nuclear attack or similar disaster was formalised through the NAWS arrangements between the BBC and the Cabinet Office. However, as a result of the limitations of this system in the present day, from the falling numbers of long-wave receivers in homes to the delay incurred from having to restore transmitters following an attack, the Cabinet Office has since cancelled their NAWS arrangements with the BBC. With international news, I'm Jason, VK2LAW.
For those interested in some heavy reading, the complete report on the proposed United Kingdom abandonment of AM broadcasting can be found online at tinyurl.com/uk-am-going-away. Some good news for those involved in digital voice communications, as the FCC says it's okay for hams to use TDMA technology. At least they can for now, as we hear from Amateur Radio Newsline's Norm Seeley, KI7UP.
The FCC has granted a request from the ARRL for a temporary waiver to sections 97.3C5 and 97.307F8 of the Commission's rules. This is to allow amateur stations to use additional emission types, including single and multiple time slot time division access, better known as TDMA. In granting the ARRL request, the FCC agreed that such a waiver was warranted so as to permit hams to transmit communications on amateur bands above 30 MHz using single time slot time division multiple access systems currently on the market and used by stations in other services. This pending the resolution of a related rulemaking proceeding. The FCC order also dismissed as moot a previously filed request from the ARRL for clarification of the rules as they apply to TDMA digital emissions. For Amateur Radio Newsline, Norm Seeley, KI7UP in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Those interested can read the entire text of the FCC decision to grant this waiver online at tinyurl.com/FCC-ARRL-TDMA. From the United States of America, we are the Amateur Radio Newsline, heard on bulletin stations around the world, including the KC6 OCA repeater, serving Lake Isabella, California. Big changes are coming to the Federal Communications Commission. This is Chairman Julius Genachowski announces his plan to step down from his post in the coming weeks. Genachowski, a Democrat, was nominated by President Obama and confirmed for the post by the Senate in 2009. The announcement of his departure comes only a few days after Commissioner Robert McDowell announced he was stepping down from his FCC post. McDowell was the first Republican appointed to the independent agency by President Obama. According to the online newsletter Politico, Genachowski's decision was predicted for months and was likely to come the same week McDowell was to announce that he was resigning. Politico added that since nominations for agencies like the FCC are paired by political party, leaving one seat on the commission for a Democrat and one for a Republican would smooth the path for the new nominees. The FCC is led by five commissioners who are appointed by the president and must be confirmed by the Senate. They each serve a five-year term. The United States Supreme Court has ruled that the first sale doctrine covers a copyrighted work legally made abroad and imported into the United States without the copyright owner's permission. In doing it, so overturns a second court decision that said it did not. The case was Kurtzsang versus John Wiley & Sons. Supap Kurtzsang is a Thai-born U.S. student who imported and resold in the United States less expensive copies of Wiley's textbooks manufactured for sale abroad. Wiley took Kurtzsang to court, claiming that the doctrine of first sale forbids his actions. But in a split 6-3 decision, the Supreme Court justices concluded that there is no geographical limitations on the first sale doctrine that would limit its application to copies made abroad with the copyright holder's permission. The decision appears to limit a copyright owner's ability to control geographic distribution of publishing his, her, or a company's works. The first sale doctrine simply means where a book is first printed versus where it's first sold. The ARRL celebrates its centennial in 2014. They've launched an unprecedented $10 million fundraising initiative. This for the purposes of building the ARRL endowment and strengthening the organization's financial future. Mary Hobart, K1MMH, is the ARRL Chief Development Officer, and she says that the vision of the ARRL Second Century campaign is to secure significant financial resources that will open a path to passionate involvement in amateur radio for new generations. Hobart goes on to say that this will provide opportunities for educational enrichment, community service, and personal achievement through the exploration and the use of the magic of radio communications. The Second Century campaign is being led by the ARRL Board of Directors and an 8-member committee headed by David W. Brandenburg, K5RQ. The campaign has already raised more than $4 million towards the $10 million goal. Plans are to reach the $10 million mark by the end of the ARRL's centennial year in 2014. More details on the campaign can be found online at tinyurl.com/ARRL-second-century. A new scientific communications breakthrough of sorts is being reported by Discovery News. It says the task of building a perfect playlist for your smartphone or other private listening device has just gotten a lot easier thanks to a new brainwave scanning device called Miko headphones. Amateur Radio Newsline's Cheryl Lasik, K9BIK, has more.
Miko headphones are a development of a company called NeuroWare. The rather interesting-looking headphones have what the company calls an electroencephalograph sensor that protrudes to scan the wearer's brain patterns to match a person's mood with an appropriate song. When plugged into a smart device running Miko's app, it's claimed that the headphones will detect the wearer's state of mind and select a Neuro-tagged, mood-fitting song from NeuroWare's database and play it. The sides of the earpieces illuminate when music plays and even shows symbols correlating to the wearer's state of mind, such as if the user is sleepy, stressed, or highly focused. Currently, the headphones are still in the prototype phase. They made their debut at the recent South by Southwest Conferences and Festival in Austin, Texas, but the Miko headphones inventor was optimistic. They'll be on the market in what they term as the near future. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Cheryl Essick, K9BIK, in Zion, Illinois.
You can read more about the latest developments in wearable consumer electronics at tinyurl.com/brain-scanning-headphones. The company's website is simply http://neurowear.com. And before you ask, no, these new earphones cannot locate that rare DX station you're hunting for on 20 meters. Well, at least not yet. Some names in the news. The Institution of Engineering and Technology reports that Professor Hugh Griffiths, G4CNV, has been awarded the A.F. Harvey Engineering Research Prize. The organization says that Griffiths is one of the leaders in research in bistatic radar, where the transmitter and receiver are located separately rather than using a single antenna. The 300,000-pound check that comes with this honor will enable Griffiths to continue his investigations into bistatic radar. 300,000 British pounds is about $456,000 in United States bucks. More on bistatic radar and its award to G4CNV is online at tinyurl.com/UK-radar award. Sequestration notwithstanding, the National Association of Broadcasters has announced that U.S. Representative Greg Walden, W7EQI, will be a speaker at this year's NAB convention in Las Vegas, Nevada. Walden, who's chairman of the Communications and Technology Subcommittee of the House Committee on Energy and Commerce, will discuss his career in broadcasting and legislative issues as one of the speakers at the convention's opening session, Monday, April the 8th. By way of background, Greg Walden has represented Oregon's 2nd Congressional District since 1998. He also spent more than two decades as a radio station owner and uses his small business and technology experience as chairman of the House committee he serves on. In November 2012, W7EQI was unanimously elected to serve as chairman of the National Republican Congressional Committee. Heil Sound will once again be one of the major hosts for this year's Amateur Radio Operators Reception, to be held in conjunction with the 2013 National Association of Broadcasters Convention in Las Vegas, Nevada. The Amateur Radio Operators Reception is traditionally a big draw for hams attending the NAB show. It also attracts those who may have never touched a push-to-talk button or learned Morse code. This is because of the nature of broadcasting and of ham radio are both communications. The 2013 reception will be held Wednesday, April 10th, from 6 till 8 Pacific Daylight Time in Ballroom B of the Las Vegas Hotel and Casino. Typically, between 700 to 800 people pack the ballroom, each hoping he or she will be the lucky winner of one of the door prizes. Everyone attending the reception is eligible to win a door prize and is handed a raffle ticket upon entering. This year, there'll be more than 140 prizes given away. In addition to those from Heil Sound, others have been donated by broadcast equipment manufacturers, engineering consulting firms, retailers, and the American Radio Relay League. The NAB says the 2013 prize list already has a value of more than $14,000. Again, that's the 2013 NAB Amateur Radio Operators Reception in Ballroom B of the Las Vegas Hotel and Convention on Wednesday, April 10th, from 6 till 8 p.m. Bob Heil, K9EID, and company president Sarah Heil says that they hope to see you there. The Radio Club of America is inviting the submission of abstracts for consideration and presentation at its upcoming Wireless Technology Symposium to be held Saturday, November 23rd in Orlando, Florida. The club is seeking papers dealing with numerous areas of telecommunications ranging from antennas, broadband, land mobile satellite, semiconductors, and amateur radio, just to name a few. If you're interested in being a presenter at this year's symposium, you'd need to submit a 1-to-3-paragraph abstract by July the 1st. Include the title, authors and contact information, a synopsis of the work to be presented, and why you think the work is interesting or important to the wireless industry. Also, please keep in mind that the conference planners are looking for specifically technical papers and not marketing presentations, and that participants will have to fund their own travel to the Orlando event. Now, those that are selected will be given a 20 to 45 minute presentation opportunity on November the 23rd, and your paper of any length will be made available on the RCA website and at the event. Those interested should send their presentation abstracts to the Tech Symposium Chair, John Fasella, at techsymposium@radioclubofamerica.org. If you missed that email address, it'll be in the online text edition of this week's Amateur Radio Newsline report. This is Ham Radio News for today's Radio Amateur. From the United States of America, we are the Amateur Radio Newsline, with links to the world from our only official website at www.arnewsline.org, and being relayed by the volunteer services of the following radio amateur. We're sad to report the passing of one of the most beloved people in the world of amateur radio and in the amateur radio supply industry. This with the word that Evelyn Garrison, WS7A, of Sammamish, Washington, passed away in her home on February 26th following a long battle against cancer. Best known in the ham radio circles as one of the early sales representatives for ICOM America, Evelyn went on to form her own organization known as Evelyn Garrison and Associates. Amongst other things, she and her company were responsible for making Alinco a known and highly respected part of the world ham radio marketplace. More recently, she was the marketing representative for Jetstream Amateur Radio Products and introduced the Jetstream brand to all of North America. Originally from Porter County, Indiana, Evelyn held an extra class license. In addition to her love of amateur radio, WS7A was an accomplished painter and also enjoyed calligraphy. And no major ham fest or convention was complete without Evelyn's smile and always upbeat conversation to make attendees feel as if they were a member of her very own family. Evelyn Garrison, WS7A, is survived by her 4 children, 4 grandchildren, and 8 great-grandchildren. Services were held Saturday, March 2nd in Issaquah, Washington, and an online commemorative to her with a guest book where friends and associates can pay their respects is at tinyurl.com/WS7A-memorial. One of the early pioneers of FM and repeaters on the 220 MHz band has left us with the passing of Walter Deem, K6PEA of Laguna Hills, California, on February the 25th. A career staff member at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, Deem was then WA6PEA, and he got deeply involved with ham radio through the JPL Amateur Radio Club. In 1976, he became interested in VHF and UHF repeater technology. Due to lack of 144 and 440 megahertz frequencies available in Southern California, he decided to break new ground by establishing the club's 220 repeater system. That system went on the air in March of 1977. And in 1979, with the split of the Southern California Repeater Association with 2 smaller organizations, Deem became a member of the 220 MHz Spectrum Management Association. There he served on the organization's technical committee during the group's formative years. After his retirement from JPL, Deem moved to Laguna Hills, California to be closer to his son. When the FCC made vanity calls available, Deem briefly held W6CWD. But then realized that most people remembered him for the letter P in his original call, so he traded W6CWD for K6PEA. This was the call which he held at the time of his passing. A memorial celebration of Walter Deem's life was held on Tuesday, March the 19th. From Down Under, word that registrations are just starting to be received for the 2013 Wireless Institute of Australia National Field Day, which takes place on the weekend of April the 13th and 14th. This happens to fall adjacent to the IARU World Amateur Radio Day that falls on Friday, April 18th. The Wireless Institute of Australia National Field Day is not a contest. Rather, its aim is to introduce amateur radio to the general public and hopefully attract more people to the hobby. At the same time, it presents an opportunity for VK hams to hone their emergency communication skills. Details on the 2013 Wireless Institute of Australia National Field Day can be found online at tinyurl.com/WIA-NFD. A new schedule with reduced shortwave transmissions begins on the BBC World Service April the 1st. As part of the change, shortwave and medium wave transmissions in the English language will be reduced by a minimum of 6 hours each day. Also, shortwave Arabic language broadcasts will cease completely. You can read the full change announcement at tinyurl.com/BBC-World-English. The 3rd annual Days of YLs contest, sponsored by the European Radio Amateur Organization, will be held May 18th and 19th. The purpose of this weekend event is to get as many YLs and XYLs to take to the airwaves at the same time as possible. Various awards will be available. For more information, frequencies, and operating times, please see tinyurl.com/YL-contest on the World Wide Web. And a reminder that the International Marconi Day will take place on April the 20th. For more information and to see which stations are taking part in this event, please take your web browser to www.gb4imd.com. NDX JR1IZM will be active as 9XOZM from Rwanda until March the 14th. He plans to operate on 80 through 6 meters QSL via JO1CRA. VA3 QSL is heading to the Caribbean and will be on the air as 8P9HI from Farther Away Cottage, Bayfield Street, Philip, Barbados, between April the 6th and the 13th. His operation will be holiday style on the high frequency bands. You can QSL via his home call sign, direct or via the Bureau. DF8DX will be on the air from Tanzania as 5H1DX between April the 20th to the 28th. His operation will include the activation of several islands on the air entities. Listen out for him on the high frequency bands and also some Earth Moon Earth weak signal operation if you make contact QSL direct via DF8DX. Down the calendar a little bit, K3LP has announced on his webpage that he'll be operating from Antarctica, Port Stanley, the Falkland Islands, Chile, Argentina, and Uruguay between February the 2nd and the 16th of 2014. This is a family vacation, so he plans only to be on the air a few hours at each location. QSLs will go via his home call sign. Lastly, Bill Moore, NC1L at the ARRL DXCC desk reports that the 2013 9X0ZM operation from Rwanda has been approved for DXCC credit. Cards may now be submitted for this one. And finally, this week, as most hams know, the big thing these days in tiny computers is the Raspberry Pi, spelled P-I. This is a computer on a credit card-sized circuit board that's finding a variety of ham radio applications. So as we approach the 1st of April, our roving reporter, Pierre Pullin' My Leg, set out with his trusty 20-meter single sideband HT and a 33-foot rubber ducky antenna to unravel the mysteries of this device and to find out if this Pi indeed is square.
Then we first tried the Raspberry Pi. They found it to be very crunchy, even though we were expecting a more mousse-like consistency. Then we learned it was a computer, and we spit it out bit by bit. Some investigative reporting led us to a secretive group working on new devices similar to the Raspberry Pi. Calling themselves the Pi Round Consortium, members of this group are designing several specialized devices, such as the CamPi, which will control automated nutcrackers. Also in the works is Cherry Pie, designed for use in lie detectors, and Apple Pie, which will be very expensive and do very little, but is still expected to be highly successful. Finally, an offshoot of the group in Italy is sticking with the traditional Pi R square formula and has designed a Sicilian Pie, which will make you an offer you cannot refuse. All of these new devices will be introduced to the amateur radio community at this year's Dayton Hamvention. Hams there are expected to gobble them up as tasty alternatives to Hara Arena hot dogs. In the Pi safe aboard the good ship Lollipop, this is Pierre Pullin-My-Leg reporting for Newsline.
Pierre says if you found that story a little bit hard to swallow, he recommends a little whipped cream and a broad smile. He adds that more of this may be, or maybe not, found online at tinyurl.com/well-maybe. With thanks to Allen Labs, AMSAT, the ARRL, the CGC Communicator, CQ Magazine, the FCC, the Ohio Penn DX Bulletin, Radio Netherlands, RAIN, the RSGB, the Southgate News, Twit TV, Australia's WIA News, and of course, roving April 1st reporter Pierre Pullin' My Leg, that's all from the Amateur Radio Newsline. Our email address is newsline@arnewsline.org. More information is available at Amateur Radio Newsline's only official website, www.arnewsline.org. You can also write to us or support us at Amateur Radio Newsline, 28197 Robin Avenue, Santa Clarita, California, 91350. A reminder that the nominating period for the 2013 Amateur Radio Young Ham of the Year Award is now open. Full details and a nominating form are on our website, www.arnewsline.org/YHOTY. For now, with Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF at the editor's desk, I'm Jim Davis, W2JKD from Florida's Sunshine Coast, saying 73 and a very happy April 1st, and we thank you for listening. Amateur Radio Newsline's copyright 2013. All rights are reserved.